Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Boyce Upholt about his new book, The Great River, The Making and the Unmaking of the Mississippi. We'll also hear from Brooke Champagne about her new book, Nola Face, A Latina's Life in the Big Easy. Boyce Upholt is an award-winning journalist who lives in New Orleans. His writing has appeared in The Atlantic, National Geographic, Outside, The New Republic, and Time, among many other publications. Today we're talking about his first book, The Great River, The Making and Unmaking of the Mississippi. Boyce, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. I'm so glad to be here.
Now, there are so many books about the Mississippi. Not to throw down the gauntlet or anything, but, you know, do you remember your first glimpse of the river? Do you remember the first time you saw it and knew it would be important in your life?
The first glimpse and when it was first important to me are probably different moments. So I've lived in the South for 15 years now, but I grew up in New England and really didn't think about the river that much. So obviously, you know, learned about it growing up in middle school, high school. I think I saw it visiting colleges in Minneapolis for the first time, probably.
Oh, how funny.
Yeah. But then I wound up kind of through the whims of life working for a nonprofit in rural Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta, so land that was literally built by the river. And was there for 6 years before I really saw or thought about the river that much. I mean, crossing bridges, you'd see it sometimes, but you can't see it because of the levee. But what happened is I wrote a magazine story about a canoe guide named John Rusky, who's now a very good friend, and went out for a couple nights camping and canoeing on the river and was just blown away by how beautiful it was, which is not, you know, I had grown up in New England, had the sense that it was engineered, it was polluted, that it wasn't going to be a wilderness space. And I was just shocked that it was and shocked that I hadn't known that for so long. And that sort of from that moment on, I just kept wanting to go back and kept wanting to write about it.
So what was it that made you commit, that made you go, this is the time, this is the book, I'm really going to do this?
Yeah, I think it was gradual in some ways. I mean, partially it was, like I said, I fell in love when I first saw it. And I was just starting as a journalist then, but it, you know, I wanted to spend more time there. It was the only really wild feeling space in the Mississippi Delta, which is very agricultural and so therefore very sort of regimented. It's got very straight rows of soybeans and corn. And so at first, I think it was just an excuse to get back out there. I would just find another magazine that would let me write something about it and went back again and went back again. And then it didn't take too many trips before I said, I've got an interest here that, you know, I knew one day I'd want to write a book. I knew a book was a lot of work and a lot of time. And I was like, well, if I keep wanting to come back here, I think that this thing could sustain my attention. But even at first, I thought it would be sort of more literary essays about the Delta in particular and about the landscape right there in the place where I lived at that time. And partially, it was just a lot of mentors were saying, you know, if you want to sell a book, you're going to have to be more ambitious than some quiet little essays about a wilderness in Mississippi. And so it took me some time to wrap my head around, am I capable of sort of capturing 4,000 years of history about a watershed that occupies 40% of the lower 48 states and putting that into a book. But eventually I said, all right, I'm going to rise to that challenge. If that's what it takes to write a book about the Mississippi, I'll figure out a way to do it.
And you found your way in.
I did.
One of the books you refer to several times, it fascinates me. It's a 1946 book by Borges, and it's called On Exactitude in Science.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that book and why it's so important to you.
Yes. So On Exactitude in Science is actually not, it's from a book called The Aleph. It's a short story, but even to call it a short
one page.
One paragraph. It's sort of, I've loved Borges since I first read him in college. And he, this quote story is sort of a fake snippet of a lost text. And so it's this just like, there's ellipses on both sides of this paragraph, and it's just supposed to be a little surviving fragment. And it is basically a fable about an empire where the cartographers became so ambitious that they made maps that were essentially one-to-one scale, the map of a city. At first, it said a map of provinces as big as a city, and eventually the map sort of blanketed the whole empire. And there's this beautiful image in the story of, obviously, that's not very useful, so nobody uses this map, and it slowly decays, and there's just tattered pieces in corners. And so it's, I don't know, when I first read that, it's, as someone who loves to explore, as someone who loves maps, that image had always stuck with me. And then one of the sites that I encountered early on when I knew I was going to start exploring the Mississippi River more fully is this Mississippi River model outside of Jackson, Mississippi.
That was fascinating to read about.
Yeah. So the Army Corps built this in the 1940s, sort of, I think, by happenstance at the same time that Borges wrote that story. Maybe there's a chance that Borges knew about it. But the Army Corps, for, you know, 100 years at that point, a little more than 100 years, they had been engineering the river, and every decade or so they'd get more ambitious and more ambitious about what they were doing. And to me, they made this, so I think it's 200 acres. It's as big as Disneyland, sprawling in the hills outside of Jackson. And it's a huge swath of the watershed reproduced so that they could basically run fake floods through that and see how those floods would perform given the levees and the different, you know, floodways that they had. And it too was not very, much like Borges's map, it proved difficult to make useful. And so it also is now decaying in the woods, and you can kind of sneak through these falling down fences and walk through there. It's a very, I don't know, it's one of the better ways to wrap your head around the scale of what we've done is to visit that. And so those two things together, that made me realize that was a good way into this book.
I think you've made, you know, a real case for tourism of that model. A lot of people are going to want to sneak in and take a look.
The city of Jackson may not love that because it's not expressly allowed.
But I liked it.
Yes.
I liked it a lot. Now, one of the things I loved about this book was that it's a book of firsts, so many firsts. The first levee in 1720, the first steamboat in 1811. And you write a lot about steamboats and steamboat culture. And the first crop dusting company in 1925, which later became Delta Airlines.
Yes, that underscores where the name came from.
So. And then the first train crossing a bridge at Davenport, Iowa. The first College of Engineering in 1850, which wouldn't have happened without all this Mississippi exploration. And I love it because you roll along with all your stories and then you drop one of these little facts. And it's such a reminder of how much has happened, how quickly. You know what I mean?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I think those firsts became necessary. I mean, one of the big challenges that I made for myself when I took on this topic was, as I said, I wound up winding back 4,000 years or more. And so how can I, and there's no central character, obviously, that has been around for 4,000 years except for the river itself. So had to find some way to, you know, help readers stay oriented towards that progress. And so it was useful as I was doing the research to always look and find, okay, what is novel in this moment so that I can really indicate all of these changes happening, cultural changes, scientific changes, all of these things that pour into the gradual way that we've reshaped and rethought about the Mississippi.
Now, you paid a lot of attention to the kinds of metaphors we use when we speak about the river. We talk about the war on nature. We talk about the Mississippi as the great obstacle to Western expansion. And it's really, we haven't thought about it very kindly, have we?
No, I mean, yeah, it's in the American era over the past 200 or so years, it's almost always thought of as an enemy, as an obstacle. The Army Corps, right? Even the fact that it's an Army agency that we've put in charge of our engineering says something about that. And their language in the past has often been quite martial in talking about battles to fight the river. One of the quotes that comes up again and again is from William Alexander Percy, who was a poet that lived in the Delta, and he talked about the river as an unappeasable god, which I think is a better metaphor than this sort of fight and this battle, in that it's pretty true. Anything we've done along the river feels temporary. The river overwhelms our engineering, and we can hold it for but a moment. And so that metaphor I like more because it acknowledges the power that we'll never be able to fully wrap our hands around.
It's always a little bit ahead of us.
Yes.
I mean, and this is a story of great eccentrics. George Rogers Clark, James Eads, of course, my fave. How could anybody not be enchanted by that story of him and the diving bell?
Yes,
really? And Andrew Humphreys. And they always agreed that the river was not only, I love this, knowable, but also tameable.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, I mean, there's another great book, The Rising Tide by John Barry, about Eads and Humphreys. And so that's the one thing that struck me, though, as I read that book and as I tried to condense an already great book into a single chapter for mine, was that this is just this brutal battle between these two engineers. And yet they were ultimately, in my mind, kind of working towards the same thing, very subtle tweaks on the same idea, which is, how are we going to control and tame this river, rather than the more broad consideration of should we be trying to tame and control it in this way?
Now, the final section of the book, of course, is devoted to what you call the unmaking of the Mississippi. So I want you to talk a little bit about that and how you feel. Do you feel hopeful? I love that Stuart Brand quote, which I remember from reading when it was first spoken.
Yes.
We are as gods, and we had better get good at it. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the last section is not about the unmaking, but the fruits of the unmaking. I think the subtitle, this Making and Unmaking, everything we've done has been a making and unmaking on the Mississippi in some ways, right? We've made the Mississippi River that we have today, and in doing so have unmade a different river. And in terms of hope, I feel multiple ways. I mean, one of the powerful things to me about the lower Mississippi River specifically, so that's, you know, the river that begins at the bottom of Illinois where the Ohio comes in, the Missouri's already come in up in St. Louis. It's a very, very big river, so big that it's always been hard for us to control. You know, here in New Orleans, the levees are quite close to the river, but further north in Mississippi and Arkansas, because of how meandering the river is, the levees have to be set a little bit further back. And so that is what made the river so beautiful when I first found it, was we've just kind of set this space aside saying, I don't know, this is too much. We can't conquer it. And so going out there just always gives me hope and revitalization, a reminder that in the center of our continent, there is this wild space. I think we have a lot of challenges with climate change, with the way our country has been developed. It's going to be, you know, I wish it was easy enough to wave a magic wand and yeah, restore the Mississippi River as it looked 300 years ago or thousands of years ago. But, you know, I also love New Orleans. I lived in the Mississippi Delta for 9 years. There are places that both mean so much to me and that would have to stop existing if we took away our engineering. And so there is no, I don't know, a lot of people ask me, what should we do? And I'm like, I'm a sort of journalist historian, and it's more comfortable to look at the past than to look at the future. I do have some hope that, you know, there's a number of other Mississippi River books have come out this year, and they're all, I feel like, akin to my book, and that they're willing to look at the river, consider points of view that have not been considered as much, Black views, Indigenous points of view. And so it makes me hopeful that there is sort of to use a watery metaphor, a rising tide of
right,
people thinking differently about this river.
We've been talking with Boyce Upold, whose splendid new book is The Great River, The Making and Unmaking of the Mississippi. You can meet him Thursday, June 20th, when he appears in conversation with Nathaniel Rich at Octavia Books at 6 o'clock, and then again Friday, June 21st at Porgy's Seafood Market, 236 North Carrollton, at a special dinner telling the story of the river through food. For tickets, go to boyceupold.com. Boyce, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan. This was wonderful.
Brooke Champagne teaches in the MFA program at the University of Alabama and lives in Northport, Alabama. She's a New Orleans native, though, which is clear from her first book, a memoir and essays called Nola Face, A Latina's Life in the Big Easy. So funny, so smart, such an unusual and clear portrait of the complexities of life here. Brooke Champagne, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan. This is wonderful.
Now, this is really an unusual New Orleans book because we don't have that many memoirs of Latina lives here. So talk a little bit about that, would you?
Yes, I think that's true. And it's one of the reasons why it was both important for me to tackle and write, and also I felt, can I? Should I? Because there really, to my knowledge, wasn't any kind of foremothers that I was aware of, Latinas in the Big Easy, writing about that. But ultimately, I just had my grandmother and her stories and just a lifetime of trying to understand her and understand my city, and feeling like, even me saying that, my city, mm-hmm. you know, it feels unusual because I left it at 17. You know, once I went to college, I'd never have lived there again. So I thought, wow, I don't really know the city that well. I've lived more of my life out of it than in it. So I felt that weird, you know, I didn't feel like I had any sort of ownership or understanding. And then again, I did have these stories and I did have my upbringing there. So I think I took that with me as I've lived other places. I think moving away from it was really sort of illuminating in that I could write about it because it is where I'm from. Yeah, we all own New Orleans, I think. Yeah. Everyone who stepped in it, you know.
Well, you know, there's this poet, Kathleen Fraser, who says, one hears one's childhood and it is ancient. And it's true, you know, yeah. And a New yeah. Orleans childhood is particularly ancient, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I love that.
Now, a memoir like this is, of course, wrapped in family stories of all different sorts, funny, tragic, you know, the day-to-day, the huge event, all these little things. But at the heart of this book is Lala, your grandmother. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about her and then read a bit about what you'd written.
Of course. She was so many things, enigmatic, but also plainly herself. But those selves, as I think I hope I represent in the book, are so varied, so contradictory, that you sort of never knew who you were going to get when mm-hmm. you encountered her. And I'm pleased to say this is not just my interpretation. Other family members who've read the book, particularly the way I've characterized her, are like, oh, yep. She could both be so chained to propriety, so almost prudish, and then do things that were outlandishly immodest, I could say. So she had these ways of vacillating back and forth that were confusing as a child, but then as soon as I sort of understood narrative, I got some kind of hold of narrative. I was like, she's actually a character mm-hmm. in addition to being a person, and a person who I loved so much and who I miss every day.
Well, just the way she'd come in late at night and say, let's go to the Café du Monde.
Yeah.
That's like the dream grandparent.
You know, it is, but then also I was like, it's a little scary. It's a little dangerous. I wasn't supposed to be doing it. I was the first child, the oldest. And so I did have that sort of type A wanting to follow mm-hmm. rules and do things correctly. And of course, she's here teaching me how to steal and sneaking me out at night. So
I know. I too had a shoplifting grandmother.
Oh, you did?
And is.
Right.
Well, read a little bit from the essay, Lying in Translation.
Soon after we all recovered from the storm, Lala called me a writer for the first time. Escritora. It sounded syllabically a little too close to Enriquita, Lala's dummy nickname for me when she was in one of her moods. But what matters is the context in which she called me una escritora. She decided she wanted me to tell her story. Needed me to. This was a demand. I was elated to get her permission, though, ever her granddaughter. I was going to tell it anyway. Still, the problem remained. What story did she mean? Which version? For any given incident, she held several accounts that suited her at different times. We never stole. And remember how fun stealing was? Americans chirped their detestable language, but she had no problem with English. In her entire life, she'd never been loved enough, while she was also the luckiest, most beloved woman in the world. In that same phone conversation, she said something I'd never heard before. You're so eloquent in Spanish. I can't imagine how beautifully you're able to express yourself in English. I think I responded with the same self-deprecation I always do, like my eloquence in any language was news to me. But it later struck me that this was her first recognition that there are two Brooks, one for each language, one she had no easy access to, and she loved them both. I may not be her Cielito anymore, but I'm her Escritora. She'd given me a laurel I'd earned instead of just a pet name, a cariño meant for anybody. It was a hard-won gift, One she didn't have to steal. One I didn't have to lie for. This gift was the opposite because it required the truth. It was the best gift she'd ever given me.
To be called a writer by a family member is a great gift because it gives you permission.
Yeah, I still remember that phone call, and I feel like that was when I didn't know when it would happen, but I knew that for sure that I'd tell her story someday. I'd been plagued with self-doubt, I think, as the book can attest to, just about in every respect one can be, maybe like most people, I think. But I thought, well, this really is permission, and some people may not like it, and, you know, but it's something that she said. So, and also, it's the, you know, she told me to do it, so I had to.
Well, I love your descriptions of being from all over the city and what that means, and also the way you wrestle with legitimacy. You know, is this yours to write about? So tell us a bit about that, and tell us about the title, too, of course.
Nola Face. Well, Nola Face refers to my dog, Nola, who we rescued after Hurricane Katrina. You know, all dogs are weird in their own way, but she just had this crazy habit of only when she saw female dogs, we had to do tests. My husband and I, is that a male dog? Well, that's why she gets along with them. And but if there was a female dog, particularly the more beautiful purebred kind, she would just really lose it and just have this sort of face. Her face would change. Her body would change. And I mean, she would like vibrate with her anger. And then I wondered, you know, did she learn that from her mama, me? And yes, this legitimacy question, I think, is, and which, you know, it's funny that I say that about Nola, that I think she had that too, because we don't know her origins at all. We just, my husband found her on the LSU lakes one day shortly after the storm. So we never really got a full accounting of what mixed breed she was. She had several, you know, I think this was even before the time of DNA testing on dogs. So, but yeah, I had the same thing too. And where am I from? Lala would always say things like, oh, you're Ecuadorian, you have pride in that. And I was like, well, I've never been there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Also, and everything that I'd ever read, all of the canonical works of New Orleans are, you know, they're French Quarter based or Uptown based. They're the right kind of places.
So I'm curious, who was it who showed you it was possible to be a writer? You know, I think for everyone who comes along, there is somebody somewhere who says, you can be a writer. This is what being a writer looks like.
I've had many of those people. I think I was lucky in Lala that telling stories itself out loud was an art, so that she was obviously the first one. But I got my undergraduate degree at Nicholls State in Thibodaux, Louisiana, and I think the first person who really was like, you have a voice, which I, you know, get, that's something that has still eluded me, even in the decades since then.
No.
But my poetry professor, David Middleton, at Nicholls State, just really said, you know, this is something you could do if you wanted. And I was like, what? I took a class because, I always enjoyed writing, English, reading. I mean, reading was my life. But the idea that it, like, I was singularly equipped in some way, I just didn't think that that was really true. And he articulated that, and I thought, he feels sorry for me. You know? You know, it's just that. But, you know, it kind of stuck, because then I applied to graduate school and got in, and, you know, that was history. But I guess I just thought, having like a simple life of being a poetry professor, living in a small town, it just seemed kind of really great. But then I was coming from a family that was like, I mean, like Lala said, when I applied to graduate school for writing, she was like, you already know how to write. What are you doing?
Yeah, so right.
it was a little bit foreign to a lot of my family to just like get an MFA. Like, what is that? What's it going to do for you? But it's done a lot for me, so I'm glad I did.
We've been talking with Brooke Champagne, whose new book is Nola Face, A Latina's Life in the Big Easy. Don't miss it. Brooke, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's been such a pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Garth Risk-Hallberg appears in conversation with Gary Cernovitz and signs The Second Coming, Friday, June 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. There will be a night of poetry celebrating Justin LaCour's newest chapbook, This Fire, and featuring Kate Root, Lauren Burgess and M.A. Nicholson. Monday, June 17th at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Claudia Gray, the pseudonym for writer Amy Vinson, celebrates the publication of The Perils of Lady Catherine de Bourgh, the third book in the Mr. Darcy and Miss Tilney mystery series, with two events this week. She'll discuss her work with New Orleans writer Genevieve Essig Tuesday, June 18th at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop, and then she appears at a new Jane Austen-inspired murder mystery party Thursday, June 20th at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. This ticketed event, Check for Prices, is an escape room-style event produced by Killer Theater New Orleans Murder Mystery Experiences. Voice Uphold appears in conversation with Nathaniel Rich and signs The Great River, The Making and Unmaking of the Mississippi, Thursday, June 20th at Octavia Books at 6. One Book, One New Orleans and Liminal Lit present a generative workshop, Taking Your Work from the Page to the Stage, Tuesday, June 20th at 6 at Miel Brewery, 405 6th Street. The workshop will be conducted by playwright Fernando Rivera and based on Mona Lisa Saloy's Black Creole Chronicles. Free, but reserve a spot ahead of time. Brooke Champagne reads from and signs Nola Face, A Latina's Life in the Big Easy, Saturday, June 22nd at 5:30 at Blue Cypress Books, and again Sunday, June 23rd at the Liminal Reading Series at the Domino at 6. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.